The word thrive has its origin in the Old Norse word thrifta, meaning to grasp. In Middle English, thrive meant to grow or increase. Today, we use the word synonymously with positive terms like succeed, prosper, flourish, and blossom. However, thriving is rather specific. It may require resilience, for example, but doesn't just relate to surmounting difficulties or stem from hardship. We distinguish it from prospering because thriving involves progressive evolution, whereas prospering denotes only success, primarily monetary. If you're coasting, doing the unchallenging thing that you do well, you're not thriving because you're not developing. Similarly, if you're performing well and attempting fresh challenges, but you're constantly stressed and not enjoying yourself, that's kind of success as well, but doesn't count as thriving. To realize the exquisite state of thriving, Daniel Brown, a psychology professor at the University of Portsmouth, says an individual must possess some, but not necessarily all, of the following qualities: enjoyment of learning, optimism, adaptability, self-esteem, social competency, flexibility, motivation, just to name a few. It's not a rigid recipe. Motivation and social competency might work well for one person, but a blending of enthusiasm, optimism, and adaptability might work best for another. At the heart of thriving is a person enjoying a sense of development, growth, or getting better at something, and succeeding at developing new skills. In the purest terms, what sustains a person who thrives is feeling positive about life, themselves, and mastering something. That something might be themselves. One tenet of Your Brain on Pain is to teach you how to thrive and to move from striving to thriving. So it's imperative we understand what thriving is. I'm your host, David Hall, and you're listening to Striving to Thriving, your resource for reclaiming your life from chronic pain. I dedicate this podcast to the memory of Dr. Lisa Jo Stearns. It is because of her inspiration that this podcast is possible. Let me say at the outset that all pain is real, including your pain. Let me say that again. If you are suffering from chronic pain, your pain is real. Pain serves as a protective means to aid in our survival. It protects us from doing or continuing to do harm to ourselves. If we touch something hot with a finger, we respond with what seems to be an instantaneous response, though it isn't. An incredible number of things happen between the time you touch that hot surface and retract your hand. The nociceptors, those nerves that sense pain in your finger when you touch a hot iron, they fire, sending electrochemical messages through your arm, up through the spinal cord, to your brain. The brain uses multiple regions to assess and process the pain information it receives and decides what to do with that information before sending a descending message back down your spine to your arm, causing a motor response to retract your hand from the hot surface. This is a grossly simplified description of nociceptive or painful response to a stimulus that is potentially harmful to the body. So in this simple example, pain, called acute pain, served a very useful purpose to protect you from further harm of being burned. But chronic pain is different. Chronic pain serves no biological or protective service. There's nothing useful or purposeful about chronic pain. The difference between acute pain of a burn, sprain, or surgical procedure is that it will last a few days, weeks, maybe several months. But after 3 to 6 months, your body has accomplished all the healing it will ever do. Yet, your pain still exists. So we label it as chronic pain. And there is one of the biggest medical mysteries that after thousands of years we're still trying to understand. Why? Because chronic pain is so complex. And because of its complexity, it's often misunderstood by both laymen and physicians, and yes, even so-called pain specialists. Adding to the complexity is that chronic pain adversely affects all biopsychosocial domains of a person, which is the reason we cannot simply treat chronic pain by examining only a person's biological or physical condition alone. Why? Again, because of chronic pain's complexity. Chronic pain brings with it psychological, social, and even spiritual baggage. Medical schools train physicians to address only the bio part of the biopsychosocial equation. That leaves the other two-thirds untouched. In future podcasts, we'll address each of these domains and teach you how to sift through and hire, ultimately build your own multidisciplinary team of providers that will help you craft an individual treatment plan for best possible outcomes. And we'll talk extensively about measurable outcomes throughout these podcasts. We'll help you move from striving to thriving. So you want to stick around and subscribe to this podcast. If you've been in chronic pain for any extended period, the probability is high that someone along your journey has minimized or discounted your pain experience. The probability is even higher that some of those people have never understood the far-reaching effects of chronic pain. Some medical professionals might have even gone so far as to label you as an addict because you wanted more or stronger pain medications. A well-meaning doctor might have assumed you to be a malingerer without taking the time to understand you as a patient, and even less, as a person. Sadly, this is not an uncommon experience for those suffering with chronic pain. Remember, I said pain is not all physical or biological. Let's not forget the psychological and social challenges you face every day of your life. Add to that cocktail of life the requirements and demands of your job, marriage, parenthood, and only you know what it took to maintain some semblance of balance and normalcy as you forged your way through yet one more day of pain. Another reason chronic pain is so complex is that it manifests itself in so many different ways. Arthritis, fibromyalgia, back pain, migraine, CRPS, trigeminal neuralgia, shingles, nerve damage, just to mention a few. Consider phantom pain of an amputee who still experiences chronic pain even though the damaged tissue has been amputated. Consider that there are multiple treatments for each of these conditions I just mentioned, and what works for one might not work for another. This podcast is for two primary audiences. Foremost, those of you suffering in chronic pain every day will hopefully find benefit because of the education and the information that we'll provide. Research has shown that patient education can help reduce chronic pain simply by being armed with information that's useful in your decision-making process. The second and no less important are those of you practicing professionals who faithfully provide support and care for your chronic pain patients. From time to time, I'll have interviews with various providers to give you the latest and current developments in chronic pain management. The subject content will initially be general, but will provide you with some basic concepts enabling you to better manage your pain. I'll continuously be on the watch for the most recent studies on chronic pain and what that should mean to you and your providers going forward. The listeners of this podcast are responsible for their own medical care, treatment, and oversight. All the content provided here, including treatments, dosages, outcomes, profiles, advice, messages, and postings, are for informational purposes only and does not constitute providing of medical advice and is not intended to be a substitute for independent professional medical judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The information presented in this series aligns with the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, or CARA, of 2016, which established the Pain Management Best Practices Interagency Task Force. Their mission was to determine whether gaps or inconsistencies between practices for acute and chronic pain management exist and to propose updates and recommendations for those best practices. The task force comprised 29 experts who have significant experience across all disciplines of pain management, patient advocacy, substance use disorders, mental health, and minority health. The draft report describes the preliminary recommendations of the task force, and it was submitted to Congress in 2019 following a 90-day public comment period. The final report was published in May of 2019, and it aligns with and supports the underlying principles on which I started my book and this podcast. Here are some major recommendations. First, the establishment of individualized patient-centered care in the diagnosis and treatment of chronic pain. This is important as each patient's experience is unique to them, as are their challenges and complications unique to them. 2. Develop an effective treatment plan after proper evaluation to establish a diagnosis with measurable outcomes, focusing on improvements including quality of life, improved functionality, and activities of daily living. Measurable outcomes become important for two reasons. First, one's health is always critical. And second, if one form of therapy, drug or otherwise, is ineffective, it should be discontinued. We should consider using more treatment modalities when shown to improve outcomes. These include the following 5 broad treatment categories: medications, including non-opioids and opioids, restorative therapies, Interventional approaches such as image-guided minimally invasive procedures, which are available as both diagnostic and therapeutic treatments, and these include trigger point injections, RFAs or radiofrequency ablations, cryoneuroablations, and neuromodulation. Next, behavioral health approaches, cognitive, emotional, and social aspects of pain. And finally, complementary and integrative health, including acupuncture, massage, movement therapies, spiritual, and more. To obtain a copy of the report, do an internet search for Pain Management Best Practices Interagency Task Force, and you'll find the link to the PDF on that first page. The report is about 70 pages with about 50 pages of additional resources, acronyms, and bibliographic references. The report is for both patient and providers and has a wealth of information. Pain often produces psychological effects such as anxiety, depression, anger, to name a few. Interdisciplinary biopsychosocial approaches offer the most promising outcome for patients with chronic pain. However, for most patients, and clinicians for that fact, such care is difficult to get. Their care is hampered by several barriers, some of which are institutional, organizational, educational, and reimbursement related. Providers frequently perform expensive procedures before they even consider other options such as prevention, counseling, and physical therapy, which are common features of successful treatment. Further compounding the patient's challenges are adequate pain treatment and follow-up, sifted by the mix of intermediate diagnosis and societal stigma wherever knowingly or unknowingly are applied to people in pain. This is most likely when patients do not respond to a treatment prescribed in isolation from other practitioners also providing care. People in chronic pain suffer more than physical pain. They have to suffer through others' discrimination and ignorance of what chronic means in the context of either bio, psycho, or social domains. This is frustrating when you learn that your doctor, who is without pain, doesn't understand or comprehend or empathize with the chronic lifestyle. Even worse, when your doctor has never heard of, seen, or received any training in your disease, as is often the case with CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome. Few doctors even know what that is beyond hearing the four letters. And even if they know the clinical definition, that doesn't mean that they comprehend and even less empathize with the challenges of the lifestyle of somebody who lives in chronic pain. Those of us in chronic pain never know how we'll feel when we wake up in the morning, which is assuming we ever got to sleep. Sometimes it takes hours for me to loosen up and limber up in the morning. Donning socks and pants might be the most painful part of my day. There were times when my wife and I would prepare to go out for an evening, but I was in so much pain I didn't feel like doing anything but staying home and not moving. Others outside the immediate family rarely understand the social aspects of chronic pain. We suffer from ignorance of people thinking they know what we can and cannot do. When getting out of my truck parked in a handicapped spot, one person told me, "I can't see that you have a handicap," to which I shouldn't have responded, but I did. I said, "I can't see that you have a brain, but that doesn't mean you don't have one." Let me state the obvious. Chronic pain is often unseen, but the experience is very real nonetheless. Chronic pain suffered by patients is not limited to physical pain. Often physical pain takes a backseat to other forms of pain, rarely discussed in casual conversation, or even in the doctor's office when sitting before the physician. The focus is characteristically on physical symptoms that fall within the doctor's specialty. Most general practitioners, or PCPs, are not the best option for either managing or treating chronic pain, let alone overcoming chronic pain. The typical GP will afford you 10, maybe 15 minutes in an office visit. This is inadequate to develop a comprehensive plan to address all the facets of living with chronic pain. Dr. Nora Volkow, MD, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse in Bethesda, Maryland, at a Senate hearing testified. She stated, "If you're a veterinarian, you get more training on how to address pain than if you're a medical student. Students in veterinary school spend 5 times as many education hours focused on pain management as compared to students in medical schools. What are the actual hours in training? A 2011 study in the Journal of Pain found that U.S. medical schools allot a median of 9 hours of training on pain management, compared to a median of 19.5 hours in Canada. In the U.S., that's approximately and only 0.3% of the total curriculum in hours. Considering that chronic pain plagues about 20% of our population, That's a huge disparity between the education and the need that the community has. Congress and health officials have criticized medical schools for failing to teach doctors about pain management, but medical schools and residency programs are quickly moving to address the issue. This disparity is documented in the report mentioned earlier in this podcast. The role the GP provides to the chronic pain patient is limited, as therapies required to overcome chronic pain other than physical fall outside their domain and formal training. The best they can do is to facilitate and coordinate communication between practitioners if they possess the time and the desire to do so. There are pain specialists, clinicians, typically MDs, DOs, or PhDs, etc., board certified in some aspect of pain management. Since pain is a ubiquitous problem, it is difficult to conceive of a physician who does not treat pain in one form or another. Further, each physician treats chronic pain based on their perspectives and their specific training. Osteopathic pain specialists can dismiss chiropractic care in favor of proposing drugs, injections, or surgical procedures. Practitioners of alternate care typically encourage their methods of nutrition, mindfulness, alignment, and movement over those of traditional medicine. Western medicine physicians often dismiss those treatments and therapies not considered mainstream. It took decades before Western medicine accepted acupuncture as a viable treatment now offered in various facilities for a specialty office such as physical therapy facilities and hospitals. Even so-called pain doctors' capabilities may come into question. From personal experience, I believe pain doctors fall into two categories. The first group practicing in pain management are often little more than pill-pushing needle jockeys focusing on short-term outcomes and symptoms and getting you in and out of their office. While this statement sounds harsh, it is one reason for the opioid issues existing today and one of the reasons for this podcast. This punitive label, however, should not apply to all pain specialists. The other classification of physicians focusing on pain treatment are those who treat the patient as a person and not merely a collection of physical symptoms. These doctors deserve all the respect chronic pain sufferers can muster. They are as much teacher and educator as they are physician. They make significant investments in building relationships not only with the patient, but also with other professional practitioners outside their competencies. They reach out to other professionals willing to have their conclusions and diagnoses challenged. Their philosophy is none of us is as smart as all of us, and they're willing to consider the skills and capabilities of others as necessary to your well-being. A patient-centric pain specialist that has your best interest at heart will never be insulted if you or another practitioner in another discipline might question them, because they recognize that treating chronic pain takes a multi-dimensional, multidisciplinary approach. So this begs the question, how does a chronic pain patient find such a doctor? Well, I'm fortunate because I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and we have Barrow Brain and Spine, Mayo Hospital, and the Center for Pain and Supportive Care, which is where I met Dr. Stearns, who gave me my life back. Outside a large city where you have a Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins University, etc., you're going to have to build your own multidisciplinary team. And that will be the subject of many of these podcasts as to how to do that and how to manage the communication between those professionals. As a point of clarification, just because you might live in a large city that has large hospital facilities, that's no guarantee that facility will provide a multidisciplinary approach or have all the resources needed to treat the biopsychosocial domains of your condition. That being said, the chronic pain patient has to be their own advocate and will give you the tools and the means for being able to do so. Our brains control every aspect of our lives. Your brain routes data or information through the central and peripheral nervous systems to the rest of your body. Then there is the autonomic nervous system, which is divided into the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, each having a specific function. And let's not forget the sensory-somatic nervous system that comprises both sensory and motor neurons in the cranial and spinal nerves. Let me share some interesting brain facts with you. Every cell in your body is wired to send information to your brain. Your brain has 100 billion nerve cells and 1,000 trillion synapses. Each synapse is wired into the most complex data network that passes information throughout your body and to your brain. Your body uses electricity generated by electrochemical reactions to send information to your brain. Your brain doesn't just receive information from your body, but sends directions back to your body, instructing it what to do. Once information arrives in the brain, it's routed all over various parts of your brain so your brain can process and interpret that information into meaning. Your brain reads everything that's going on in your body about 30 times a second for your entire life. There are specific regions of the thinking brain where we fully experience pain. But these parts of our brain do a lot more than just simply perceive pain. They deal with emotion, memory, decision-making. They regulate respiration functions, digestion, and hormones. When someone tells you that your pain is, quote, all in your head, technically, they're correct. But what they mean is your pain is imagined, which might still have some small element of truth, as our life experiences have influence on how our brain processes pain information. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We only experience pain when the electrical signals reach the thinking part of our brains. But you might say, if pain is only in my brain, then why does my back ache? And we'll explore that question in more detail in upcoming podcasts. But for now, the proof of this truth is best understood using phantom pain as an example. Phantom pain is the pain an amputee feels in a part of his body that no longer exists, say, for example, an arm. Though the arm is amputated and the tissues around the amputation have healed, the person might still experience pain that they had prior to the amputation. Again, it's called phantom pain, and it's real. There's a saying in pain management, it ain't pain till it reaches the brain, which is the fundamental truth upon which we'll move forward. Most chronic pain conditions cause literal changes in the brain, reinforcing and fortifying the pain cycle. Neuroscientists call this centralization of pain, meaning the pain itself changes how the nervous system works. Patients actually become more sensitive and experience more pain with less provocation. And there's more. Chronic pain changes your brain's structure. Let me introduce you to what I call the triple whammy. Chronic pain changes your brain in three ways. First, chronic pain changes your brain's structure. Neuroimaging studies have shown that chronic pain can alter the size of certain regions and change the connectivity in between these regions. The way different parts of the brain talk to each other becomes atypical. For example, it affects the areas of the brain involved in reasoning, analysis, motor planning, and memory. This explains why many patients experience fear, anxiety, or depression with chronic pain. Unfortunately, these additional symptoms just exacerbate the underlying pain condition, but there's hope, and I'll talk about that. Second, chronic pain alters your brain chemistry. Chronic pain stimulates the brain to generate abnormal levels of chemicals called neurotransmitters. In the right amount, these transmitters create the perfect balance of activity and inhibition so the brain reaches a Goldilocks level of function. Not too much, not too little, just the right amount. However, abnormal amounts of key neurotransmitters prevent certain brain regions from turning off when they should. This results in a brain overly sensitive to pain and stimulates a feed-forward cycle that reinforces the chronic pain state. And again, we're going to cover that in more detail in upcoming podcasts. Then the third whammy is chronic pain modifies your brain activity. Scientists have learned brain activity patterns among patients with temporary pain differ significantly from those with chronic pain. Although the sensations of pain feel the same in acute and chronic pain stages, the way the brain processes the pain is different. Researchers found as pain morphs from acute to chronic, the representation of pain in the brain shifts from classical pain areas to brain regions associated with emotion. This might explain why treatments that work well for acute patients don't provide relief for chronic pain patients. Now for the hope part of the equation. It is important to note that these changes in your brain, while they seem and feel and sound scary or overwhelming, they are not permanent. The brain is thankfully moldable and plastic, which is where the term neuroplasticity comes from, And with the right treatment strategy, you can reprogram it and reset pain processing systems back to normal and halt the centralization of pain and prevent it from causing further damage. I'd like to share with you a quote that I found. It comes from one of the reports that I used in preparing today's program. It says as follows. I have a master's degree in clinical social work. I have a well-documented illness that explains the cause of my pain. But when my pain flares up and I go to the ER, I'll put on a hospital gown and lose my social status and my identity. I become a blank slate for the doctors to project their own biases and prejudices onto. That's the worst part of being a pain patient. It strips you of your dignity and self-worth. To close on more of a positive note and provide you with hopefully a small shift in perspective, I'd like to share with you an experience I had last year. I met a person new to the chronic pain support group in which I participated as part of my physician's practice. When she was asked to introduce and tell us a little bit about herself, it was as if a switch was thrown and the floodgates opened. Tears streamed down her face. Grief and pain appeared as her countenance seemed to hit the floor with a deafening thud. As she told her story, she wept. She wept profusely. She described her physical pain, the depression greeting her first thing in the morning, the isolation that she felt, and her frustration with medical professionals treating her as an addict, and even worse, discounting her pain. She was ready to give up on life. After she finished her discourse, I took her hand and I asked her, "Do you know what we call your experience?" She looked up through tear-flooded eyes and in a quiet voice uttered, "No." I responded, "Normal. It's normal." Something inside this wounded woman, this woman carrying more than physical pain, something inside her clicked. It seemed as if an enormous part of her stress and pain melted away, as though the weight of the world was lifted from her. She felt some relief to know that she was amongst her own people, a community of fellow survivors still struggling in similar ways. She understood her struggles weren't hers alone. Pain is part of the human experience. We all experience some manifestation of pain during our lives. Whether acute or chronic, we all experience suffering and its consequences. While pain can serve as a warning to protect us from harm, it can also cause extreme and even merciless suffering, surpassing any original cause to develop into a disease, into multiple domains with far-reaching consequences. We may all share common experiences and expressions of pain, but in reality, our experiences with pain are personal. We filter them through the lens of our unique biology, through the society and community in which we were born and live, the personalities and styles of coping that we've developed, and the way our life journey experienced health challenges and disease. If you struggle with any of the manifestations of chronic pain, you're not alone, and this podcast is for you. Please know that I will always honor your time, your heart, and your health. I'm David Hall, and until next time, be kind to yourself.